Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride!
Good evening and welcome to the second, yes, you're not hallucinating, the second December episode of The Three Horsemen. On tonight's episode, we are actually four horsemen strong. Not only do we have myself, Fred Kish, Jeff Patterson, John Stevens, but we are joined by our very special guest, Karen Burnham of Locus, FSF Signal, and a real-life rocket engineer. Good evening, Karen.
Good evening.
Good evening, Jeff.
Good evening.
And good evening, John. Good evening, John. Well, we'll hope he's still here.
Good evening. Good evening.
Just to let you know, it's been an eventful evening, so we're going to hold the contact information for myself, Jeff, and John until later. And start with introducing Karen. Good evening, Karen. Why don't you tell us, our faithful listening audience, a little bit about yourself?
Cool, thanks. So I'm a book I think of myself mostly as a book reviewer. On Twitter, I'm at Spiral Galaxy. You can usually find me online at spiralgalaxyreviews.com. I've reviewed for Locus, Strange Horizons, SF Signal, and a few other places. I've got a book out this year on Greg Egan, which was a ton of fun to do. I'm also, most recently, I was the lead electromagnetic compatibility engineer for the late-lamented Dream Chaser spaceplane, and since it is indeed late and lamented, if anyone knows anyone in the aerospace industry looking for an electromagnetics engineer, give me a call.
I've been trying to get Elon Musk to answer my phone calls, but he hasn't so far.
Yeah, funny about that.
Yeah. The reason we want to invite Karen on, she has Karen Lord on another one of SF Signal's family of podcasts, Crossing the Gulf. And in Crossing the Gulf, they've covered people such as C.S. Lewis and Olaf Stapledon. Earlier this year, when John Stevens was recuperating from his cybernetic implants, and I was driving north to meet him with him and Jeff, where we recorded our Hanging with Mr. Recuperation episode, see our back issues for that. I listened for the first time in many years, an audiobook version of a book called The House on the Borderland. And I was struck by the similarity with it and Olaf Stapledon, whom Karen has covered. John and I discussed it while we were up there in his room. And here we are several months later, sitting down to record an episode about the book. So I'll make I guess we should start with a summary of the book's plot, and then we can dive into our discussion, followed, of course, by our usual culture consumed. Hodgson lived from 1877 to 1918, and he wrote a number of works of horror and fantasy, many of them about the sea. One of his most famous creations is a guy named Carnacki, who was a ghost hunter or a ghost breaker, and he wrote a couple of novels, of which The House on the Borderland was one. It's a short novel. A lot of today's readers might find it a little archaic in form, but I think that if you stick with it, you'll be rewarded with some pretty cosmic trips. The book is a nested story. It starts off with Hodgson himself describing how he got the book. It was sent to him, he says, by two people who were fishing in Ireland and who came across the book while exploring along the river they were fishing on. You then move into the book itself as those two characters read the book to each other, and it tells the story of an unnamed narrator who lives in a house with one other person, his sister Mary, and a dog named Pepper. The book is a journal that he keeps in order to describe the various strange experiences he has. For example, he starts off with having an out-of-body journey to a place he calls the Plain of Silence, where he sees an apparent duplicate of his house, and then has his the duplicate of the house menaced by a strange swine-like creature. He then wakes up in his house, his real house, but then finds himself under siege by a series of attacks from similar pig things, but this time in the real world. This is then followed by an adventure underground, another adventure out of his body in which he sees his dead love, then an adventure in which he travels forward in time millions of years to the point where the solar system dies, and finally he is menaced by the swine thing from the initial out-of-body experience and eventually apparently dies. So it's kind of a strange novel, but I thought it was worth speaking about. So who would like to start off?
Okay. I'll start off. What the heck?
I've overwhelmed you all with...
No, it's just... it's. I mean, it's... I actually just said to folks privately that I had to mute my mic for a minute because I started chuckling when Fred actually gave the plot because it's so ridiculous.
Yes.
There's a level at which this book is entirely ridiculous. And that's another thing that might give modern readers pause is that when you're reading it, you're like... you're being attacked by pig things, and your solution is to bar yourself in your house and hope they don't break the windows.
Well, of course, his house is more like a castle, so you know.
Well, it's like conveniently there are like bars everywhere, and you know, I kept waiting for like the Greek fire to be poured on them or something, but
he never did break out the catapult.
No.
Yeah, no ogres, no nothing, man. But It's like there's a level at which this is an entirely ludicrous book. But the funny thing to me when I went back into it was that doesn't matter. Like the ludicrousness is totally irrelevant because that really has nothing to do with what he's with his purpose. It really doesn't. Go ahead.
Well, can I build on that point a little bit? Because I had the same experience with A.E. Van Vogt that I've had mm-hmm. a few times with Hodgson, mm-hmm. which is that if you're trying to follow the plot or if you're trying to summarize the plot like Fred just did quite ably, it sounds ridiculous and sometimes, especially with Van Vogt, it's frankly impossible to summarize the plot. You're like, I'm sorry, wait, what? But it's so vivid.
Mm-hmm.
The prose is so vivid that it sticks with you in a way that is not common in my experience, even with writers today. There's something about the visceralness and the imagery that they use, both of them, but, you know, Hodgson in this case, that I'm not a particularly visual reader. I tend to be a little more auditory in just the way I hear the prose instead of seeing images. But with Hodgson, you almost can't help it but visualize what he's describing.
Well, he's also, I think, very good at the other senses. For example, when the initial layer of the story where he describes, you know, how he got the book, he talks about the faint pit smell of the pages and how it was clumsy to turn them because they were damp for so long. And, you know, there's other points where sound becomes important, like where when the narrator goes forward in time, he hears the clock speeding up. And eventually hears the sound of the world. But there's also things like that last sequence where he's being stalked by the creature and all he does is say, pad, pad, pad. Mm-hmm. I mean, that I've read this book, I think, 5 times this year, and that section always creeps me out the most. Just from hearing that those footsteps coming closer and closer and closer. So, yeah, he summarized the story. It sounds crazy, but like a nightmare... you can't look away. You can't get away. And it engages you.
Yes, it's very engaging. It's one of the surprising things to me was when if you read this book, things keep going on and on. And it takes them so long to go on like the first cosmic trip, right? As if he's really describing a great variance of things. It just keeps going and going and going and going. And then when he finally, you know, and then when the recluse goes on his trip, it takes a long time, and the details don't seem to build necessarily. They're just, it's like, it's a very, phenomenological kind of odyssey. It's like the things happen and the rhyme or reason will come later. You have to experience them now because that's all you can do is experience. You can't, the guy constantly says he can't make sense of it, doesn't understand. And it's like, you just have to keep going and going. And it's never going to make sense, but you have to take the journey. And it's a really uncommon method of telling a story. But I think his goal is not so much to tell a story as to provide an experience for the reader.
Mm-hmm.
He just wants you to be off balance all the time. It's this aesthetic of, you know, excessive estrangement. He wants you to feel so alienated that, you know, you don't really know what's going on. You're just totally off balance. And that's what he wants. He wants to provide you with that feeling. So the reasonability of the plot doesn't really come into play because he's trying to create a mood and try to create an experience in your head.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see that very often anymore, certainly. It's kind of a somewhat older aesthetic, I think.
It is.
Well, sorry, Jeff, go for it.
Well, no, I was going to say that the one thing that it reminded me of was there were some of the descriptive passages where he was just basically going through the setting or the aggregate of activity that was going on around him, reminded me a little bit in just the way the progression of description was done with some of the stuff that I'd read in like Wilkie Collins' books, except that Collins always tried to tell his stories in a very, very linear fashion. You know, everything had to go on this very strict, you know, progression because, you know, he was dealing in mysteries and stuff like that, wherein Hodgson sort of took that a similar structure but decided to tell this almost stream of consciousness type tale where he's just giving you these snatches of perception and experience that are going on around him and trying to feed them all into you in such a way that your terror / wonder / bewilderment sort of ramps up as each chapter progresses.
Although I guess we'd be remiss if I didn't challenge my own statement where I said, you know, that not many authors do this today, because the weird movement, and I'm thinking particularly of Jeff Vandermeer, is bringing that aesthetic back a little bit, the aesthetic that you guys are describing.
Right.
I think the reason that Fred invited me on this podcast is because I'd finished reading Vandermeer's Southern Reach trilogy, and I tweeted, like, late on a Saturday night when I was up late with the baby, I was like, Hodgson! That's who that reminds me of. It's Hodgson. And Jeff Vandermeer tweeted me back, and he was like, thank God somebody got it. You know, and again, it had that a disjointed, keeping you off kilter feel that was also, as you guys pointed out, very visceral, very mm-hmm. kind of almost pyrotechnic in its imagery and the different sense descriptions that are involved, but in not in a way that at the end of the story you go, oh, well, now it all makes sense. That you never get that moment.
Mm-hmm. The funny thing about that tweet was the reason one of the people that I thought of when I read this, actually when I read Vandermeer, the Southern Reach, was A.E. Van Vogt. Because Van Vogt would often write from dreams or dream fragments. And Southern Reach felt to me like a dream in many places.
Yeah.
You know, nothing makes sense except when you're in the dream.
Right.
If you look at the dream later, you're like, well, no, of course I couldn't fly. Of course there could be a giant eyeball, whatever. But in the dream, you're like, oh my God, it's a giant eyeball. Or a worm. That's a tunnel. That's also a tower. So.
Mm-hmm.
Well, something else I wanted to mention, though, was the visceralness that Karen describes. Like I had originally read this book in college when a guy who was in a science fiction group that I was in recommended it to me because he said there was a lot of older stuff that wasn't quite considered canon anymore and that a lot of people should read. And I read it then. And yeah, I found it a touch confusing, but I got into it. And then it was not until Alan Moore and Kevin O'Neill did the third League of Extraordinary Gentlemen volume, The Black Dossier, And there's a 3D sequence in the very back of that book where they're in the burning world with Prospero, and there's a sequence where they're looking at this portal, which is a mirror, and when you are looking at it with the 3D glasses on, you realize that the two images that you're seeing do not exactly match. You have to close one eye and then the other to see everything that's in there. And in this little four-panel sequence, what's occurring is when you close one eye, one of the swine creatures is actually approaching you through the mirror. Huh. And it actually mentions, oh, yes, this portal lets you see into the borderlands of the swine people.
Oh, wow.
That sentence alone was enough to bring back that entire sequence of the book for me from hell 25 years earlier. Mm-hmm. And I went, oh, my God, I remember that book. And I had to go and find a copy of it and reread it. And much to my surprise, when he did the fourth volume of the League, Carnacki was one of the members of it. Carnacki ended up being Nina's psychic link to the underworld. So
nice.
But it was that visceralness that came back. Not so much the story, but the whole visceralness of, hey, there's a pig guy coming at you to kill
right.
you.
So. That just seems to reinforce the idea that it's not really about the story.
Yeah.
He that's what he wants. He wants you, like, years later to go, oh, my God, I remember that feeling. I remember what that writing did to my mind. He really wants to break your mind, in a sense, with that.
Well, of course, Godfrey knows it's not about character. I think Pepper is the most developed character.
That's right.
Oh, poor Pepper.
Poor Pepper. No, poor Pepper.
Why is Pepper still a pile of ash? I never quite understood.
That, well, just so people understand, I mean, we're obviously spoiling. Yeah, but the book is from
1907. It is 90 years old. I think spoilers are allowed.
But what we're talking about here, folks, is that during the narrator's one real long trip forward into the future, he thinks Pepper is lying in the room, sleeping, and he calls Pepper once or twice, then goes over to nudge him, and the dog disintegrates into a pile of ash and bone. And then after the narrator returns back to the present, seemingly, I mean, he dies during his trip.
Yeah, that's the thing. The narrator himself turns into a pile of ash
right.
in his chair,
right.
but he comes back and Pepper's
back
still
is a pile of ash.
Like, hey!
But there's other things that don't make sense if you think about it. Like, for example, Mary. Does Mary ever actually see the swine creatures?
Nope.
Mary only acts as if her brother's gone crazy and has locked her into the house and is running around with a shotgun shooting down at the garden. So,
which is a totally reasonable interpretation of that book, might I add.
Right. I mean, did the narrator suffer a blow to the head before the first page of the journal and hallucinate the whole thing?
Right.
Or, I mean, Pepper seemed to smell the creatures, and Pepper was actually attacked by a creature, and so it's weird that way.
Yeah, but dogs can see more than humans do. So
true.
Well, and again, if you know, you can play all kinds of unreliable narrator games with Hodgson. Yeah, because you only know about right. Pepper's behavior based on the reporting of the narrator. So,
well, that's kind of interesting because, like you said, this story can be interpreted a number of different ways, and what I came away from it the first time I read it was much different and far more pedestrian than what I came away with it later on. So, because when I read it, after we saw John, when I read it then, part of me, because I tend to have this whole big giant cosmic causality fueled by having read too many comics, my take on it is that the narrator was never supposed to see the far future and the death of the solar system and the green scar, and somehow, in however this weird, unfixed motion of time, multiverse, whatever, however it functions, in the laws of this particular story, the swine men are almost like, they're almost like antibodies. The narrator perceives something he was not supposed to perceive, and now the universe has to make sure it doesn't spread.
Hmm.
That was sort of how I took on it, and I know that wasn't how I took it, how I read it when I was in college. So,
well, I know I've, like you, I kind of always approach these things and try and, without even thinking about it, unconsciously, I try and fit them into a science fictional framework. And I've had this problem with Lovecraft, where I read Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness, and I'm like, oh yeah, he's just stumbled across an alien civilization. This is cool. And of course, the narrator's freaking out, and I'm like, oh, come on, let's go exploring.
Yeah, let's get eviscerated.
but yeah, I like that interpretation. That never occurred to me.
Well, part of that also comes from the fact that I find after I did the reread of this summer, I actually reread a bunch of A.A. Attanasio stuff, especially his early books, Radix and Arc of a Dream and stuff like that. And one of the reasons that Radix had always turned me on when I first read it when it came out was the fact that he has this very surrealist and dreamlike quality to a lot of the passages of his story. And I went back and reread it and said, yeah, I can see him trying to hit a lot of the same notes and use a lot of the same furniture that Hodgson is using, but he's attempting to weave everything together. It's almost as if the narrator in the Hodgson story is only picking up a fragment of what's actually going on. And what authors like Attanasio did, and several other authors who have played in similar sandboxes, you know, are trying to say, okay, here's the glimpse of what you just saw, and now here's the big picture. You know, here's what's actually going on, and here's why this person only perceived this one little slice of it that became, you know, readily apparent to him just through his limited human three-dimensional linear time field of view. So,
we can also look at David Lindsay in the late 19th century. Mm. You know, where again, it's very dream logic, it's very surrealistic, but where Hodgson played and Lovecraft might have played that for horror, Lindsay was trying to play it for a more kind of abstract philosophical point.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, you can use that same toolbox of the kind of disjointed, kind of WTF narrative to a number of different effects.
Well, one thing I struck me, and this is another reason why I asked you on, Karen, was that, I mean, I felt like probably H.G. Wells inspired Hodgson. And I know that Hodgson inspired people like Lovecraft, but I kind of got the feeling that maybe Olaf Stapledon was inspired by Hodgson.
Yeah, you can't escape that, can you? I mean, because you know Hodgson wrote first, because Hodgson was writing in the tens and teens of the 20th century, and Stapledon was writing in the 30s. And you know, let's see, I do know that Stapledon and Virginia Woolf actually had a correspondence.
And many other people.
Right. He had correspondence with many other people. And, Lord only knows what he read. Because as soon as I started, I remember, again, I first read House on the Borderlands 10-ish years ago. When I was first going through and trying to educate myself about the history of science fiction. But I don't know about you guys. I read Stapledon first and then Hodgson. So, you know, as soon as I start into that far future passage, you know, I'm thinking, The Starmaker.
Yep.
You can't not. And then you're like, well, but you know Hodgson came first. Was Stapledon influenced? And I don't know if anyone's actually nailed that down, yay or nay.
There's one sentence in either the Stapledon entry or the Hodgson entry on Wikipedia which links the two, but doesn't cite anything.
So yeah, I'd be interested if the SF Encyclopedia made that link.
Well, I was about to say, we need to invoke John Clute. Or maybe Gary K. Wolf, but you know what I mean.
Or Graham Slate.
For those of you who haven't read him, Olaf Stapledon wrote
for
a number of books.
For those of you who haven't read him, you should.
Well, with the caveat that, like this book, it is often difficult to get through some of Stapledon's works.
True.
But in particular, three of the works, Last and First Men, Last Men in London, and Star Maker, Stapledon takes us from roughly today, or the today of his day, into the far, far future. I mean, if you look at Last and First Men was the first one he wrote. Last Men in London is like one chapter in Last and First Men. And then Star Maker has one chapter of Star Maker is roughly the period of Last and First Men. Each one just jumps that much further in terms of scope. And like Hodgson, Stapleton has an unnamed narrator who has an out-of-body experience and travels throughout the galaxy in time, experiencing all sorts of wonderful things. Much more coherent narrative, I would say, but still, you know, no name, no real character, just a series of experiences. And Stapleton definitely influenced people like Clark, Benford. I mean, you know, the list goes on and on as far as who we could have influenced or who we know he influenced.
I've sometimes thought that almost every single science fiction book ever written could fit in a sentence or a paragraph or a chapter of one of Stapleton's books.
Yes. Yep.
I mean, his scope was just that enormous. But it's interesting because Hodgson, you know, goes to that border, literally House on the Borderland. The consciousness of the narrator, who I guess is conventionally called the recluse, you know, goes to that point and recoils back. You know, so he kind of hits that border and goes, whoa, scary. Whereas later authors and you know, a little bit David Wimsey with Voyage to Arcturus before him, went to that border and went, whoa, wow, transcendence instead of horror.
This story was never serialized, was it? This just came out as a novel then?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't think it was ever picked up like in Weird Tales or any of the other magazines that occasionally did reprints in the 30s and 40s. I know that, Jeff, you read the comic or part of the comic.
Yeah, I actually tried finding my copy of it. I've got a few really nice page scans from a Richard Corbin gallery that I found. And I was as I tend to do, staring at his line work and stuff like that, and looking at the way he kind of conveyed, you know, scope and depth and stuff like that, using a lot of old fashioned illustrator tricks and stuff like that. But something else that dawns on me is that I think in the adaptation, it's actually revealed that one of the guys who finds the manuscript at the end is actually Carnacki, if I remember correctly. They did some weird trick on that. And I remember Alan Moore wrote the afterword for it as well.
I've never read that version, but the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast had a three-part mini-series on this book, and they talked about the comic, and it just seems like Corbin put a little too much spin into it that didn't exist.
Yeah.
To begin with. I mean, I don't know whether the narrator ends up looking like Den or whatever, but having Mary be raped by the pig things and like, okay, you know, whatever, guys. Wouldn't work for me. Sorry.
No, I couldn't finish that when I read it.
Oh.
Because for me, the visuals got in the way of cultivating the feeling that I got out of reading the original.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, it's almost like the visuals were too distracting.
Yeah, well, not just that, but Corbin imbues menace in anything. Any character, any glance, any gesture is always supposed to convey some form of dread, and I really didn't need that for this story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And no, the story itself is dreadful enough.
Which is kind of the other thing that kind of strikes me about the book is that the narrator, in a very, you know, artifact of Victorian writing, is so utterly matter of fact of everything that's going on. It's not until he starts pushing, you know, when he has the view of the future and stuff like that, and the stuff that comes afterwards, does terror really start to sink in when he gets into almost like the first person present tense that he starts using near the very end, where he's kind of describing everything that's going on around him. You know, to the beginning, he's got enough mind to say, okay, we have to make some defenses, and we have to, you know, things are odd. I better take care of this. I better make sure everybody's, you know, he's the soul of competent man, you know, for the sake of just being able to react well to everything that's going on. And it's not until you get into the later half of the book that suddenly it's, you know, the horror sinking into the brain that Lovecraft did so well.
Mm-hmm. Well, can we talk for a sec? Because there's a passage in the book that in the frame narrative, going back to the hikers in Ireland.
Okay, I got it.
They say they found the book and it had fallen open to these certain pages, and thus they were more damaged by the elements, so they were illegible.
Yes.
And that mostly seems to have to do with this dead love, or possibly supernatural love that he has, and all of that bit is all really, oh hey, I've got a fragment of a sentence here and a fragment of a sentence here, and then we move on. And that's a really weird trick to pull in a book like that.
Well, it's kind of, I mean, the business with his dead love, I mean, I think it's really a dead love, not some sort of supernatural love, because the book opens with a poem that Hodgson wrote to his father, which talks about someone who has died. And this man he lives out in the country by himself with his sister and his dog, and he talks about how he doesn't keep any servants because he hates them. But I wonder whether he just hates people, possibly because something happened with this woman that he loved.
Mm.
And that's why he's a recluse. You know, the one great love. I mean, this happens in real life. I mean, Patrick Moore, who was a famous amateur and professional astronomer, appeared on British television for decades in a show called, I believe, The Sky at Night. I mean, in his autobiography, he talks about how he had a love who he lost, and he never, you know, he wouldn't say what happened in his autobiography, but he, like, never loved again. You know, so some people have a great tragedy like that and turns them, you know, totally hermit.
I don't know. The way I read it, just because the lack of setup of it, I pictured it as being a sort of a more supernatural entity that had reached out to him in some way. But, you know, again, there's relatively little to go on, and yeah. Hodgson himself elides those passages. And so, yeah, everyone can bring their own, you know, bring their own interpretation to that.
I mean, when he's traveling back from, I think, the next to the last section, when he's traveling back from, was it the Sea of Silence, or however he calls it, he sees the solar system and he sees lights, and he comes across one light and there's a person inside it, whether that's a soul or an angel. So, you know, that's how I interpreted his lost love, as being another one of these floating souls, but he was able to communicate with her in this one place.
Mm-hmm.
The Sea of Silence. I mean, I know his father was an Anglican minister. Nothing I've read really talks about his own religious beliefs, but, you know, it seems that a lot of what goes on is more of a religious bent than Stapleton, who was an atheist or an agnostic and had like a universal mind and stuff, but the universal mind wasn't really necessarily God. Or there were angels or whatever, it was, you know, disembodied intelligences. And, you know, so you could put a quote-unquote science fiction spin on Stapleton's super beings, but a religious spin on Hodgson's super beings. I mean, we've got a long section underground in House on the Borderland. Is the pit,
mm-hmm.
you know, does the house sit on top of a gateway to hell? And the cave that he goes through, is that, you know, a direction from hell? Are the pig beings underground creatures like the Morlocks, or are they supernatural beings? Oh, we can run down a lot of rabbit holes.
You know, something else when you talk about the lost love is the fact that the only time she sort of gains identity and gains description and gains shape, takes on shape in the narrative, mm-hmm. only when the whole time travel thing starts to occur. In fact, if I remember correctly, there's one part where he actually says, my mind was filled with my grief and my thoughts of this future that I'm tumbling through. And I'm wondering if we're supposed to read something into that. So.
I don't know.
Well, so one question I have for you guys, do you think we'd be talking about House in the Borderlands now if it didn't have that far future time travel passage? Do you think that the rest of it, the vision of the Sea of Silence and the swine things and the pit below the house, would all that be enough? Or is it that glimpse of something just crazy, I keep coming back to the word transcendent, the thing that makes this book, you know, 90 years later, actually, no, my goodness, over 100 years later,
right.
Something we still talk mm-hmm. about.
I mean, for me, it would be, because other sections, like where he's exploring the cellar, or the last section with the footsteps, or even the attack of the pig things on the castle, all ring chords with me as far as other kinds of stories that I like.
Okay.
You know, supernatural, or just years of running Call of Cthulhu games, or or Lovecraft. You know, I mean, the reason mm-hmm. I came to Hodgson was because that quote from Lovecraft, that misquote by Lovecraft is on the cover of many of the paperback editions.
Misquote? Sorry, I don't know.
Well, there's a quote on a lot of the covers that says something like a story of the first water. And like many a movie review that gets quoted out of context, they kind of cut out a few words. I mean, he liked the book. But it gives a slightly more of a shine than he really seems to have meant. And I'll try to find the quote while somebody else talks.
Well, the one thing that I would say to that is, yeah, I think it still would be. But if you look at the events that occur to the narrator on a scale, the first odd thing that happens is that he gets transported to this distant landscape where all these various pantheons are congregating. And that in itself is kind of a weird little, you know, eye opener as, you know, first glimpses of the inexplicable go, to the point where an attack on your house by an army of pigmen in itself becomes, almost pedestrian, not quite, but almost pedestrian. and then you get the pit underneath. And at that point, your mind is going, okay, where is this all leading? If he had taken another tack, if going into the pit had, you know, sent him back to his own past where he was reunited with his lost love, or if he had suddenly found himself, you know, back in that weird valley with the arena from the beginning and stuff like this, I certainly see that, you know, it still could have worked as a story. But and at the same time, and this is kind of the reason why I threw open the question about if it had been serialized, because if you're writing a story, it's almost, and I'm taking a guess here, it's almost like he's digging himself a hole, literally, when it comes to the pit. He's digging himself into a hole, and now he has to kind of tie everything together. And instead of doing that, he gives us the, well, let's go to the far future route, and shows us that there is something even bigger encompassing all of this, and all of these events that he's going through are merely a tiny glimpse of something that's much larger that he's now got access to. Whether that be directly through the house or because of his experience earlier, or the fact that, you know, maybe the land with the arena and the pantheons, you know, did something to his perception and now he can see more, you know, at that point, who knows? But I would say yes to answer your question with the qualifier that it would depend on what was there in lieu of it.
Yeah, the thing is, Karen, you said that you could fit all of science fiction to William Hope. I'm sorry, into Olive Stapleton, Starmaker. It's almost like you can fit all of horror into this novel because you've got, you know, the siege, you've got the psychological horror section at the end, you've got creeping through the cat. I mean, it's like he didn't write one novel, but he wrote the versions of many novels.
No, that's a good point. That's a really good point.
It's kind of strange. Were you about to say something, John? Or I cut off somebody.
You cut me off.
I'm sorry.
Damn it, Fred. No.
Yes.
I was actually going to say I think it's really necessary. I think this is really, in some ways, this is an organic whole, this novel. Because it does something that it actually really exemplifies Hodgson's philosophy of reading. He first has to knock you on your ass, mentally speaking. So that what comes after, which is serving other purposes for him, feels more disheveled and estranging than it might normally. It's part of the frame he wants to build to put you in a place where subsequent events have more of an impact than they would have if he hadn't prefaced it the way he did. It's very intentional on his part. I mean, think about one of the first things that I think this is from his introduction. There's a quote. It's hard on the Kindle to pinpoint quotes. He reads, "I read, and in reading, lifted the curtains of the impossible that blind the mind and looked out into the unknown." His idea of reading is that it simultaneously sort of lifts the veil, but exposes to you to things you can't understand. And the only way that he can knock you off balance enough for subsequent events to continue to do that when he shifts the frame is to do what he does in the beginning, to really blow your mind. And you don't know where you're going, and you don't know what this is, and even the narrator can't process it. So when other things subsequently happen, the narrator becomes simultaneously more unreliable and yet more sympathetic.
I had not thought of that.
Yeah, I went a little meta there, sorry.
It's okay. No, I expect no less of you, John. So.
But no, I mean, it's really amazing to look at this and to think about the philosophy of reading and the philosophy of reality that he's employing in this. Because both of those make what he does in the beginning essential to the success of the entire book.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree that you can't have the rest of the book without what he did in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're absolutely right. Without that, you know, the rest of it doesn't hang together at all. But do you also need what he does in that, I don't know, what in like Act 4, I guess you'd call it, with the transcendent far future? And of course, one thing that Hodgson does, I'm not actually that much of a fan of Hodgson. There's stuff he does that I like, and there's stuff he does that I just really can't stand. But one thing that I do like is that it, reading all the books of his I've read, Nightland, I read House on the Borderland, I read Ghost Pirates, I think I read one other. It brought to my mind this idea of what literature was like before the walls of genre went up. Because if you read that far future portion, I mean, so much of it is relatively either scientifically accurate or scientifically plausible given what was known in, you know, 1906 to 1908.
Yeah.
You know, about the atmosphere, you know, the sun dying out and the atmosphere freezing, and what would that look like? It's very, you know, what you'd almost think of as hard SF of the time. But then you've also got this horror, and then you've got this fantasy, and then you've got this transcendent philosophical stuff. There's so much going on there, but that's really reminiscent of what you had. You had Hope Mirrorweaves with, oh dear Lord, Blood in the Mist.
Yep.
Was a very different kind of fantasy than what we think of today. You know, George MacDonald and David Lindsay. It was a different time where you blended weird and horror and science fiction and fantasy and just whatever, you know, it all goes. Why not? Let's throw it all in there and see what we come up with.
Well, because readers were more generalized too. There weren't science fiction readers and mystery readers. There were readers. And there may have been like connoisseurs versus, you know, pulp, say, there might have been general, like, large distinctions, but there really weren't as many distinctions for readers either, so that makes a lot of sense, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it almost struck me as more, when I was going back and rereading in that period, it almost struck me as more exuberant, in a way, more experimental, just because, you know, it wasn't like people were following rules or playing with rules. The rules just weren't there yet.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at... Now, I think of, like, Stoker, this, and Wilkie Collins versus novels of today. Very, very different.
Yeah.
You know, journals and... You know, people just don't do journals or narration like this as much anymore.
Well, the other thing is that, I mean, when you, if you look at something like the Nightlands,
mm-hmm.
which...
Do I have to?
Yeah. One of the things that he's doing in there, a riff that he appears to be playing, though he may not actually be, is the whole idea of human nature having certain transcendent aspects that we do not fully comprehend. And I think he's trying to manifest that in the Nightlands. And to an extent, I think he was trying to manifest that in this as well. I mean, you've got a pit and you've got an abyss and you've got a man with an absence in his heart that he's, you know, trying to cope with. And the culmination of all of this is him seeing the death of everything. Strange enigmatic things in the far future, the green star and the solar system, you know, converting into its final form and stuff like that. If I was going to draw a conclusion between the two, it would be like, perhaps that's the thing that he's trying to, that's the riff he's trying to play here, is the idea that the transcendent aspect of human nature is somehow the abyss itself, you know, that somehow everyone's carrying, you know, this absence, this hole, this whatever in them. And in the case of the narrator, it allows him to see, to perceive
mm-hmm.
death and horror and absence on a massive scale, not only in this other world that he goes to, not only in his own life, not only in the pit and the things that it contains, but, you know, everything, it, all existence around him. It says, oh, by the way, you think you have a hole in your heart? Check this out. Boom. This is what the solar system looks like. And I think that might have been just in looking at his other works, that tends to be something that he tends to sort of lean over towards and point to gently. And if he was doing that in this book, that's my take on it.
Funny thing is, Jeff, the way you described it, I suddenly realized this would really work as a Marvel comic.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because there is a passage in Radix by Atanasio, when I was talking about the comparisons,
mm-hmm.
when the protagonist goes through one of the mind-altering states that he goes through during the course of the story, and what he sees is almost the death of the solar system sequence from this book, almost in reverse. He's seeing, you know, the solar system losing cohesion, and he sees the Earth, you know, fall apart into, you know, rock and plasma and stuff like this, and his mind starts going backwards almost to the origin of the solar systems. And I actually went and read the two passages back to back, and even though there isn't a lot of similarity in sentence structure and a lot of similarity in the way these things are described, there certainly is a definite sense of, hi, you are now experiencing something that you're not meant to perceive in a manner that you're not meant to perceive, that you're not built for, that your brain doesn't have the toolbox for. And in both cases, the characters are almost reduced to simply giving this description, and in the course of the description coming incredibly poetic in the way that they're doing it.
Right.
You know, being very lyrical, as if this strange time lapse of natural forces, orders of magnitude above us, is something that can be rendered into almost a poetic state. And Marvel, you know, Marvel Comics has certainly done a lot of things where they say, hi, we're going to show you really big things now, but they always, you know, convey as much of it as they can solely through the art. It wasn't until you got guys like Grant Morrison and Alan Moore that came in and started, you know, doing lots and lots of text boxes around the funky little illustration that they've put in, that they really try to describe a scope and really push for a sense of wonder. But when you're reading it in a comic, you turn the page and you see the two-page, you know, Jack Kirby spread of the heat death of the universe, and it's, you're staring at that for several minutes, and then you've got to go around and read the description. And if you're still carrying that sense of wonder when you get to the end of the text, then yes, they've done their job correctly.
Mm-hmm. Well, have we beaten this one into the ground?
I don't think humanity will ever beat it into the ground.
Yeah, I was about to say, I don't think that's really a possibility. But
yeah, I think that when the heat death, or when the death of the solar system actually does roll around, whatever post-human entities are there are going to be sitting there with their copies of this book going, eh, it could have been better.
And they'll be saying, poor Pepper, no!
That too.
We have this Pepper into ash.
I was just thinking that the only reason to have Pepper go out that way is because I wonder if Hodgson, knowing what had to happen to the second dog, didn't want to have that happen to Pepper.
Oh, that poor second dog. Yes.
Yeah, poor second dog.
That poor cat. The only one that survives is Mary. Somehow, somewhere,
that
maybe.
We know.
Yeah.
That we think. I mean, we don't. Frankly, the narrator, he locks her in his room, and then what? It's like days before he actually goes to say hi again. I mean, seriously, really?
Well, folks, I hope you are, folks in the listening audience, I should say, I hope you were interested in our discussion, and I hope this leads you to read the book, because really, I mean, I read it 4 or 5 times this year alone, and each time something else surprised me or kept me gripped or on the edge of the seat, as I was tweeting earlier tonight when I got to that part with pad, pad, pad. Creepy stuff. So, shall we move on to culture consumed?
Sure.
Who would like to start this evening?
I got a couple things.
Okay.
All comics this time around. The three that I'm going to mention, we had 2 first issues come out this past week that I was pretty impressed with. The first one was Dan Abnett's Death of Apollo, which sort of takes place between the original Galactica and the dreadful Galactica 1980. And it's basically it's 10 years after the attack on the colonies. And I believe this is going to be a 4-issue series. I'm not certain, which basically Apollo, if you remember, was not a character in Galactica 1980. And this story sort of tells what happened to him. And why he's not in there. But it's kind of interesting because it gives us a glimpse of the crew as we knew them 10 years on. And that alone was what I carried out from it. At this point, they have not seen Cylons in a few years. Mm-hmm. But they are, they pick up a signal from one of the ships that they left behind at the very beginning of the escape. And they now have a new hope for finding Earth. But they think that if they try to take advantage of it, it may draw the Cylons' attention. It was very well written. Dan Abnett's done a lot of Galactica stuff. I think this is his 4th series that he's done, and I've liked it all so far. But this issue was really nice because it was a glimpse of very familiar characters the way we remember them at a point that we never saw them before, and it was kind of fun. The other book I really want to recommend is the first issue of Escape from New York, which literally takes place immediately after the end of the movie Escape from New York, where the president basically rescinds the pardon for Snake Plissken and the army goes after him, and he ends up in the strangely transformed version of Florida that has arisen in this dystopian world. And it's all pretty much classic Snake Plissken. You really wish they had made this instead of Escape from L.A., but highly recommend it. And the other thing, second issue just came out. It was originally called Tooth and Claw by Kurt Busiek, but now it's called Autumnlands Tooth and Claw because it turned out Image had already released a book called Tooth and Claw several years ago. They are describing it as Conan meets Commandy meets Game of Thrones, which is actually a fairly accurate description of it. It is a future, a post-human future where the various animals have formed various tribes and there's a degree of sorcery that's going on. And there's a little bit of kind of a prophecy, which is actually based on old texts that they have. And they are trying to find out that there's this, they're trying to find that there is a ancient champion that they're trying to find who we discover in the second issue is not who they were expecting and certainly not who we were expecting, but it's very good. Wherein a lot of anthropomorphized animals tend to be humans with animal heads on them. This book, the art by Benjamin Dewey, which is excellent art, does a really good job of designing these evolved animals that sort of all walk on two legs and have their own little, you know, wardrobes and their own little tribes, and their cultures are really well defined. And second issue's out, and it's really good. If you're a post-apocalyptic fan or if you are a epic fantasy fan, I think this will play well for either groups. That's all I got.
John or Karen?
Oh, I'll go next. Sure. I mean, didn't we talk about this last week?
Sure.
And we'll talk about it next week.
And I'm not going to have an eighth of what either of you guys have. But anyway, so I actually just finished, finally, excruciatingly, a collection of early Jack Vance works. And I'm sad to say excruciating, because there's also brilliant moments in it. But it's a Grand Crusade, which I'm going to write a fuller review for Press Up Signal. And despite the fact that it's hard to read a lot, and with my, you know, sad modern sensibilities, I wanted to punch the narrators a lot, there's still just, there's interesting stuff in there if you can go through it. Like, I'm actually really conflicted because some of the writing is just not good. But then there are these moments where something really fascinating happens, or he makes an interesting conjecture, or, you know, Vance's flair for sort of cultural otherness shines through, and you're like, wow, that's kind of cool, or, you know, who would have thought of that? And then you go like, oh, my God, yes, yes, women are inferior, thank you, whatever, can we get to the next interesting thing, please? So it's a struggle. I'm going to write it, like I said, a full review, but I finally finished that this week. And I'd have to leave it after a while and come back and leave it and come back, and I just couldn't take it in long stretches. But there's stuff there to find, so I'm going to try to write a review where I can talk about, you know, what I could actually find there.
Is this an ebook or?
It's going to be, Subterranean is releasing all of his early stuff in a huge multi-volume edifice.
Right.
And this is Grand Crusade is one of those.
Okay.
And then the only other thing that I was going to comment on was continuing my saga of The Flash. I saw the newest episode of The Flash this week, and my first response was, hey, somebody wrote an episode of The Flash finally. because it was as if, you know, after noting my disappointments frequently here on the podcast with the Flash, it was actually an episode where they wrote and interesting things happened, and it was actually remarkably well done. And I'm sure it just solely has to do with the fact that the Arrow was on as well, and they were doing a crossover. So I'm sure the Arrow writers probably had some input in, and they really seemed to have given it a lot more muscle. But even the dialogue sounded better. Even characters that I usually dislike, I found somewhat more interesting this time around. So I'm curious if it's going to stick or not. my fear is that it won't, and then we'll go back next week to the terrible one dimensionality and cliche that's kind of riddled it. But this week was very good, and I wanted to acknowledge that.
Karen?
Well, I guess there's one thing I wanted to mention, and so I had a wonderful experience, which is relatively rare, and I was contacted by the publisher of a very, very small press, Pixel Hall Press, and they said, we've got these two books out, is there, you know, and we know you probably get emails like this all the time, but, you know, would you like to review either of our titles? And I said, well, you know, I'm kind of interested in this one. And I picked it up, and they sent me the arc of it. It's called The Winter Boy by Sally Grotta, Grotta, and it wildly exceeded my expectations. I finished it all, I actually finished it. And basically it's written like a fantasy, but there are hints in it that it's not actually a fantasy. It's probably far post-apocalyptic SF. And basically it's this very structured society where older women, there's a sort of society of older women, and they train young men through a season. Basically, a young man is assigned to a mentor woman called the Alicia, and she brings him from, you know, the sort of fecklessness of youth into a seasoned maturity, and then he will go out to all the villages he'll get an assignment basically, but all these guys who've been trained this way go out and they maintain the peace of their society, and help everything hang together. And the story of the book is one woman who has joined the society. She's going for her first season as a mentor. She's assigned to this quote unquote problem boy, somebody who's very strong-headed, very willful, and they're not sure if he's going to make it or not. And she has to see him through. And then, of course, the way these things happen, there are also threats from the outside that they have to deal with. It challenged a lot of tropes. There were times when I thought it was going to go in a very cliched path, and it avoided the cliches almost every single time. I really appreciated that. I really enjoyed having a mature woman narrator in this situation instead of, you know, sort of a more YA focused where it's two young people finding each other, or, even two like 20 somethings finding each other. It's a very different relationship when it's a woman who's already had kids and been widowed, and a teenage boy having this relationship. And I appreciated both their perspectives. It's well written. The one critique I might have is that it's somewhat slowly paced. But I think that was appropriate considering the focus on the intimate relationship between these two people. And as the book progressed, of course, you find out more about what's going on in the wider world, why it's happening, and again, it challenged the cliches in a way that I really appreciated. So that's available from Pixel Hall Press. I think it's got an Amazon. I think it's up on Amazon. I'm planning to write a review of it, probably for SF Signal. So that's one thing that I would draw to people's attention. And the other thing is, a couple weeks ago, my husband and I got out to see Interstellar, of which possibly the less said, the better. It's one of those movies where I'm sure they say that Kip Thorne advised on the physics. So sure, I'll grant them all the math on all the physics, but boy, did they break a lot of the laws of engineering.
It's certainly been a movie that it seems like you either love it or you hate it.
Yeah, maybe. I one of the things that just stuck for both my husband and I is that very appropriately they showed something like a Saturn V being needed to get the spaceship off the Earth. But in all the other planets, the spaceships and the itty bitty little landers could all take off just with their own thrusters.
Well,
really?
Yeah. Gravity's really? Relative.
Yeah. Apparently so. Even in the vicinity of a black hole.
Yep. I heard a rumor that you also attended a convention recently.
Oh, World Fan. Yes, where could that rumor have come from?
I have no idea.
It was good to see you, Jeff.
No idea.
We're sorry we missed you, Fred.
Yeah, I got a little sick, unfortunately.
Did you get on any good panels
or hear any good panels? Or
I didn't do panels as much as I wanted to, but I had lots of good conversations with lots of very dear friends. Mm-hmm. And given everything that's happened in the year 2014 for me, that's exactly what I needed.
Okay. You're here. Yep.
It was a lovely time.
I felt the same way.
Good. All right. Well, for me, I, of course, read The House on the Borderland. But I'll mention that the my paper edition is from Nightshade Books, and they did a 6-volume set of Hodgson's writings. And if you are a book collector, it's a very beautiful set to own. They have like this blue leather binding with a silver embossing on it, a piece of artwork on the front of each one, and a portrait of Hodgson on the back of each. They are also available from Nightshade as Kindle ebooks. I'm sure Barnes & Noble and other formats as well. So those don't look quite as nice as these, but they are perfectly functional. And then I also listened several times to the Audible edition, which the narrator, I can't remember the name of the narrator, but he does he's obviously a lot younger than the reclusive narrator of the book, but he does a good job of being a crotchety old man. So he does the pacing that I like so much in many audiobooks. When you get to that pad bit, he just like creeps you out with the way he reads it. So, and that is only like $4, that audiobook. So it's worth seeking out just for the fact that you're only spending $4 on it. I'm continuing my annual, what turns out to be an annual reread of Neil Gaiman's Sandman. I just finished The Doll's House, the second volume. I am continuing my reread of Schlock Mercenary by Howard Taylor, since the new volume is going to be on its way to me at some point. So I just finished The Terraport Wars, which is the second volume of, I think he's up to 10 now for that webcomic.
I desperately need to catch up on Schlock Mercenary.
Well, you know, it's, every time a new volume comes out, that's what I say, and I sometimes do. And I am continuing to watch The X-Files with my daughter, and we got through Beyond the Sea, which is a season one episode where Scully's father dies, and Gender Bender, which is a very strange episode with pseudo-Amish-looking aliens who can change their sex. But Beyond the Sea has, I think he did the voice of Chucky, Brad Dourif or something like that.
Brad Dourif, yeah.
Yeah, and that guy is just such an amazing, he was so amazing in that episode. So creepy. Just, he really, you know, that's one good thing about that show. They often had these guest stars that would just take the role and run with it.
He does creep.
Brad Dourif is amazing in whatever he does.
Yeah. So and today, while I was prepping for this, she was watching her new copy of Godzilla, the latest version. And it struck me while I was working on notes for this that movie really did a really good job with the music and the soundscape. Because I was obviously not looking at the pictures. I just heard the music and the gunfire and the roaring and the other roaring and whatever, and it really worked well together.
do you mind if I add an anecdote that you can easily edit out?
Nope, we're not going to edit it out. We'll keep it in.
Okay, so after I had my first son, my husband would, you know, in the evening to give me a little time off, he would take the baby, and I would go and do something else. And so again, it was just listening, not looking. And he decided this would be the perfect time to rewatch the original Conan movie. And, you know, with a 2-week-old baby on his lap, rocking him to sleep. And so my experience of the original Conan movie is, awesome traveling music, traveling music, yes. traveling music, hack, hack, slash, slash, ah, and then more traveling music.
And some grunted really words of dialogue.
They really didn't waste money on dialogue for that script.
No, nope, no, they did not. That's hilarious. Well, Karen, I want to thank you again for coming on.
And thank you very much for the invitation.
Yeah, and we hope that we can again find some sort of cosmic book to discuss sometime in the future with you.
That'd be awesome.
Maybe when you get out your next volume of a nonfiction series? Hint, hint. Yeah.
I've got a proposal in my head, but I absolutely am not telling it to anyone in public yet.
Okay. All right, well, we'll keep you in mind for that. So, everybody want to say goodnight?
Good night.
Or closing words?
Good night.
Okay. Thank you all, folks, and we'll talk to you again real soon for our third December episode. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.